Hey everybody, it's Chris. We are slowly but surely wrapping up our multi-month focus on movement and technique and skills. And as part of wrapping this up, I really wanted to find out what your questions are. I very selfishly have gone down a very specific path in learning about movement, talking about movement, exploring movement these last few months, partly because, you know, this is my job and I love it. And I just really enjoy all sides of it, learning how it works, why it works, when it works, when we should apply certain things. I love all of it, whether it's what the climber needs to know or the coach needs to know. And I think those two are very different, actually. But anyway, I've got about 45 free minutes before my wife and my daughter get home. So I thought, let me sit down and try to answer some of these questions that I've gotten. I solicited questions in several places. The Instagrams, the YouTubes, our Proven Plan group chat, as well as on the Patreon. And I got great questions from everywhere, and I'm going to try to get to all of those over the next couple of weeks. So this might just be part one, but I'm starting with our patrons. And if you're interested in becoming a patron, you get at least two bonus episodes a month, sometimes more. It starts at just $3 a month, and you get those bonus episodes. You can do that at patreon.com/powercompanypodcast. All right, let's get into it. It's time to fail. Okay, first question. This one actually came to us from Instagram, but I know Cody Ratterman is a patron, so I'm going to start with him. And he asked, when do movement principles become specific to a root or crag, no longer applying to other areas? And this is an interesting question. I think since you very specifically said movement principles here, I think the principles always apply. And in my opinion, the principles are tension, position, rhythm, commitment, and effort. It has nothing to do with individual techniques like drop knees or heel hooks. It has nothing to do with individual positions like where your hips are or whether your arms are straight or not, things like that. Instead, I think it's these five elements, again, tension, position, rhythm, commitment, effort, that combine in infinite ways to make every single move everywhere possible. So I think the principles always apply. Now, that said, movement, and as we get more and more specific and more into individual techniques, I do think we should prepare specifically for areas that we're going to, roots or crags, and that those techniques may not apply as well to other areas. That said, however, I do think practicing movement, no matter what that movement is, even if you're practicing an individual technique, if you're practicing it in a way that's really targeting the principles, these five elements, then it's going to carry over in some way. Maybe not super directly, but you're becoming more adaptable while practicing any of this, especially if you're practicing for a place you're about to travel to, and then at another time in the year, you're practicing and preparing for your home area, and then you're practicing for a different trip, you're becoming more adaptable. And I think, and I'll probably say this a dozen times throughout this episode, that's the most important skill in climbing, period. So, Cody, great question. I think when it becomes specific to a root or crag and not really applying to other areas is when we start getting into individual techniques. And I think that's way down the line. I don't think we need to be really focused on individual techniques unless we're very specifically preparing. I think the principles, the five elements, will take care of all of that if you learn those well. Next up, Martin Bertram says, I normally use the kilter board at 35 to 40 degrees and project there around 7A, 7B. Now I switch the angle to 50 degrees and I couldn't even climb 6B plus 6C. Is this a movement problem? Or, generally speaking, what does the angle of the climb have to do with our movement? Is it helpful to train steep even if you climb mostly on 20 to 30 degrees outdoors? I'll start at the end of that question. Absolutely helpful. There are very few areas where it's only one angle, where it's a 20 degree pane of rock and it never changes. It doesn't ever get steeper. And you don't want to get stopped on a steep crux on a route just because you've never spent time there, or a slabby crux just because you've never spent time there. Why not get good at those things? Also, if you mostly climb on 20 to 30 degrees outdoors, and I know this is the opposite of the usual opinion that if you are usually climbing on 20 to 30 degrees outdoors, that's what your training wall at home should be, and that's how you should train. I don't necessarily agree with that. If you're climbing on 20 to 30 degrees outdoors regularly, and that's a key here, regularly, then I think you should be climbing on a different angle with different size holds inside. You're going to have better injury prevention just due to variability in the grips that you're grabbing, the moves that you're doing, the stresses that you're putting on your body are going to be different. That variability is going to improve your resilience and not overtax you in any really specific ways. So I think, yes, absolutely helpful. I don't think it needs to be tons of time to be helpful. If you're going to a commercial gym and climbing on the kilter board, then spend some time at 50 degrees. Spend some time at 20 to 30 degrees. Some time at 40 degrees. Climb on the commercial sets. I think it's better. Like I said, adaptability is king here. I think it's better to mix up the angles, mix up the hold types, and become a more adaptable climber overall. Now, in your question, you also said, you know, now I switched the angle to 50 degrees and I couldn't even climb 6B plus 6C. How long did you give that? And what's the result if you did give it a while? Was it one session and you thought, oh, this feels way harder, I'm out of here, I'm going back to 35, 40 degrees? Or did you spend a few weeks there trying to climb those grades? Because I suspect once you spend a little more time at an angle, the skills you had at 35, 40 are going to start to translate to 50 degrees, and you're going to start to be able to climb similar grades. It's not always going to be the case, but most of the time, if you give it a chance for you to adapt to it, to transition into this, I think it's going to, you're going to find that the grades are similar for you. Now, spending time at that angle relatively regularly is going to make those transitions happen faster. It just is. There's no question. Okay, next up, Matt asked, how can we or should we, and I think I'm paraphrasing this, how can we or should we prepare for how conditions outdoors might change our movement? This is a really fascinating question, and I think it ultimately comes down to what I talked about in the Taylor Reed episode with Taylor, and I believe I talked about this with Rob Gray as well. And it's this concept within the ecological approach to learning skills of repetition without repetition, which essentially means no two moves look exactly alike. Even the same move to the same hold on a different attempt is going to be slightly different in some way. There are parts of movements that the best athletes pretty closely replicate over and over and over. But the whole goal is to replicate the outcome, not the movement itself. And particularly in something like climbing, where you get a hold slightly wrong, a hold feels a little slipperier, you gave it a little too much power, or gave it not enough power. Whatever it is, slight changes lead to this domino effect, and we have to adjust and adapt. Fatigue will change how you move. Hitting hold slightly off will lead to a domino effect. Conditions are going to change how you move. And I do absolutely think we should prepare for this. Not necessarily by, you know, Adam Ondra very famously built a climbing wall in a sauna, or built a sauna around his climbing wall to prepare for the Olympics. And I think that's smart. I don't think we should necessarily be going to that, to those lengths, because I think we can learn to adapt. Again, adaptability here, by going out when the conditions aren't great. Too many people climb on hard things only when the conditions are good. They're not giving themselves a chance to adapt to how the conditions are going to change their movement strategies. There are also the folks who, when they're trying something hard and your hand is slipping off of a hold, or you don't hit the hold quite right, or you don't step on that foot quite the way you meant to, or you didn't hit your tick mark, whatever it is, they just drop off, or they just say take. Stop it. Learn to adapt. As soon as you hit that hold wrong, you now have to adapt your movement solution in order to make the next move work. And we're constantly doing that to some degree. That's the whole idea of repetition without repetition. If you're dropping off when there's any major adjustment required, your adaptation gets stunted, essentially. Why not learn to adapt? And I'm not saying you should do this every time. If you're wasting a bunch of energy and you're in red point territory and it's a good tactic to drop off, by all means, do that. But don't do that every time. Fight now and then. Get ugly now and then. That's the best way to learn to adapt to these situations where it's the last day of your trip. You show up at your project. It's humid. You're not in Adam Ondra's sauna, but you are in Chattanooga, and the humidity's through the roof, but you still have to try to send. Because it's not okay to just say, oh, well, conditions are bad, I'm going to go home and I'll come back in 3 or 4 years and try this project. You're there. You're right in front of it. Try it anyway. And the better you've prepared by learning to adapt, by fighting when things aren't perfect, the better off you're going to be when you pull onto that project. Great question, Matt. And again, I know I'm beating it here, but adaptability is king. Okay, Martin Bertram again. How can we train bad feet indoors if there are only good footholds available? This is a great question, and one that I've spent a lot of time working on myself. Obviously, I went out to Minnesota and shaped a bunch of bad feet with Escape Climbing, and we sell them. Escape sells them. So if you have your own wall, look into those feet. They're the inductors, the diodes, and the resistors. Resistors are no texture smears. They're meant to sort of induce that same anxiety as standing on a polished hold. And they work. I'm scared of them in my own gym. Diodes are no texture, small edges. So you don't have the opportunity to smear in the same way as you do on the resistors. You have to step on them a little differently, and there's still that anxiety component. And then the inductors are meant for steeper walls. There are several sets of them, and they're the inductor 10, 20, 45, and 60 based on what wall angle they're going to be challenging on. Obviously, if you're an advanced climber, we have the inductor 20s on our 45 as well. And those are small in-cut edges that are, you have to be pretty precise on. They sort of block you from using them in some directions. And they're very small and hard to toe in on. And these bad feet absolutely change our movement. Number one that I've already alluded to here is that anxiety. They're scary. It's scary to stand on a tiny foot and be able to commit to it fully. And remember, commitment is one of those five principal elements that I think exist here in every movement. You have to be fully committed to do the move the best that it can be done. And when it's small feet and when you're scared of small feet, that commitment really comes into play. Not to mention, it's just natural when you start standing on small feet or bad smears to pull harder with your arms. We're all going to do it, especially when we first start working on bad feet. So there are a couple of ways you can do this in commercial gyms where the footholds are god-awfully huge, to be honest. They're massive in comparison to like our, even our inductor 60s, which are our best bad feet, are way smaller than most of the feet on most boards and almost anywhere in a commercial gym. Now, some things you can do in those gyms. Number one, you can stand on bolt holes. You know, do some juggy climbs, purposely not standing on any of the holds. Use the bolt holes, either in the wall or on the holds themselves. And then you'll get maybe a little more friction depending on the type of wall you're climbing on. But the bolt holes can be a really great way to do this. There's also a lot of big macro holds with little features on them. Choose a feature you're going to stand on. You know, make yourself feel a little bit uncomfortable stepping on this foot and still do the move. Now, you're going to have to be really intentional because you're going to muscle through at first. Recognize that, or try to recognize that, and then go back and repeat it, trying to get more weight on the foot and then more weight on the foot. It's not enough to just climb through once, have done the moves and thought, okay, I'm good. I can now climb on small feet. That's just not true, especially if it's a long boulder or a sport route and there's lots of bad feet. You're going to be wasting a ton of energy pulling harder and harder with your arms when the feet are bad. So get good at that and notice your anxiety levels. Pay close attention to how scared you are standing on these little features or in these bolt holes, because that's what's going to hold you back. That's what's going to cause you to pull harder with your arms. That's what's going to cause you to say take or to drop off. I can't count how many times I or people I'm climbing with are in position to make the next move. They step on the foot. They bounce their foot a little bit. They look down at the foot. They reassure themselves, yes, this is the foot. They bounce on it again, and then they just drop off because they don't believe that it will work. They feel anxious about standing on that foot. That's totally normal. And a lot of hard climbing revolves around pretty good handholds with really bad feet. So it's a little shocking to me that we haven't explored that better in gyms. I do think there is a movement underway in which we're starting to use the no-tex holds or the shiny part of dual-tex holds as feet more often. And I've been saying this for years that we should do that. I think it's smart to do. But also, a lot of the time outside, it's these little tiny edges that we're not trusting. And those are harder to come by in the gym, at least in terms of feet that were meant to be feet. So you're going to have to find those, looking for either those little bolt holes or little features on existing holds or on the walls, something like that. It's not going to be easy, to be honest, but I think if you're really intentional, you can get it done. Okay, next up, I may be pronouncing your name wrong here, Yoav Pinto. Hopefully I'm close. For those who are short on time for training, can we combine movement drills with training for different energy systems? And what's the best way to go about this? I'll say some of it we can. And some of the movement drills are going to tax different energy systems just by their very nature. And I'll tell you what I mean here. So the first classic way to combine the two, I think, was probably first really discussed in the rock climbers training manual. And that's to, like, when you're doing arcing or some kind of endurance training, focusing on movement skills, because it's relatively low intensity climbing, and you can put plenty of your attention towards how you're moving. And I think that can work and does work for a lot of the simple movement drills. But it has to be a movement drill that doesn't add a specific desirable difficulty into the mix that's physically taxing. And a lot of the drills are physically taxing. There's a big misconception that movement skill work is easy and should always be easy. And at its very first exposure, maybe it should be relatively easy for you, but it should get difficult. That's how we move it into our hardest climbs. Take a drill like One Size Fits All, for example, which I just put a video out on YouTube about. That drill, which I think is one of the most overlooked and important drills you can do, is essentially climbing as extended as possible and then as bunchy as possible using any feet while on a set hand sequence. And it's incredibly taxing. I had intended, after I recorded the video, to have a bouldering session. By the time I was done recording the video, I was shot. There was no climbing to be done at any significant level. So I think that, you know, that classic way of low intensity endurance and paying attention to your movement skill can work if it's something like, I want to move with a good rhythm and I want to make sure I'm breathing well while I move. I want to keep my composure while I'm climbing, and I want to, you know, work on keeping a soft gaze. I want my precision to be on point. Those kinds of things I think can work really well with low intensity. And frankly, they should be a part of your energy system training, even when your energy system training gets more intense. So say it's something like power endurance, you are getting pumped or you are getting powered down, but those aren't the reasons you fall. You don't fall because you got pumped or because you got powered down. You fall because getting pumped or powered down caused something else to fall apart. Either you stopped paying attention to your feet and you were hitting a bunch of holds wrong, and then as a result having to pull on your arms more, and that's why you fell. Or your precision went way down and you're missing holds. Or you're getting pumped and you aren't believing that you're going to make it, so your commitment is low. Those are generally the reasons we're falling. So a really key component to your energy system training should be something like composure. If you know you lose tension when you're starting to get tired, that should be something you're really tuned into and paying attention to as you start to get pumped, as you start to get powered down. What's happening to my tension? What's happening to my rhythm? Am I starting to hesitate when I get pumped? Now let me take some steps to make sure I'm not hesitating on my next goes. So for me, I think the answer is yes, we have to combine it. Not can we, but we have to, because those are the reasons you're falling off, because your skills are degrading with fatigue. And the goal for me of energy system training, especially on the wall energy system training, which gets a bad rap these days, but I think isn't being leveraged to its best degrees. The goal of that should be to make sure your skills, to help bulletproof your skills, make sure they're not fatiguing at the same rate as they were. Improve that and you'll stay on the wall longer. Okay, next up, Lydia Benitez asks, when projecting moves in boulders, what would be a good series of questions to ask yourself after tries to determine if the movement patterns chosen are optimal versus there's a strength deficiency? I love this question, and I'm going to answer it in a sort of roundabout way here. And that's because I believe that in 99% of cases, maybe even 100%, but I'm giving it the benefit of the doubt here and saying 99. If you're trying a grade that you've either done before or you feel like you've prepared for, even if it's the next level, most of us don't walk up to something and try it if it's miles and miles over our head. Usually the things that we're trying are in our realm of possibility. If you're on one of those things, then the immediate answer after you fall off and your question is, what now, should never be get stronger. Should never be your answer, ever. More strength will nearly always be helpful. And it's worth continuing to try to build forever. I'm not questioning that at all. And some moves absolutely will require more strength than you have. But the thing is, meaningful strength takes time to build. So that can't be your answer right now. Your answer right now has to be better tactics, subtle movement changes, or looking for entirely different solutions, because those can be leveraged right now. And further here, just to complicate my answer even more, how much strength is required will always depend on the movement solution and how well you're executing it. The two are so tied together that we can't say this move requires this level of strength. It depends how you're executing that move. So as you really dial a move in, there's less strength required. You don't have to use as much finger strength to hold onto a hold as you get better at standing on the foot, as you get better at using momentum. And if you land a hold wrong or get a foot slightly off, you might need more strength to hold on to that hold or to stay in that position. So the actual answer is going to change every single attempt. It's ridiculously complicated and pretty much impossible on the vast majority of moves to strip strength and movement away from each other. They're always interplaying and working in some ratio together. Now, it's common to overlook a solution simply because we don't understand it, which makes it feel harder at first. And we know we don't find the best way to do a move first time. Rarely ever happens. Even if the technique we choose is what is going to end up working best, there are all sorts of subtleties that make the hardest moves feel doable or even feel dialed in. And so for any move you're finding exceptionally difficult, I do think there are two questions that are helpful. Number one, have I tried everything? And you have to think outside the box here. Gather beta anywhere you can, but also be creative and try any solution. No matter how ridiculous that solution might seem, you have to have tried it. And the next question is, how many times have I tried this? Because if you've only tried it once or twice or three or even four times, you haven't tried it enough. And once you've asked these two questions, you have to put the seven try rule into effect. If you don't know what the seven try rule is, essentially you give seven honest efforts. And if you don't make any progress at all on that move, even micro progress, then you might be best off giving it a break and taking the time to level up. Now, that might mean you just try other beta and give it seven honest efforts. That might mean you move to a different move on this ultimate project and give it seven honest efforts. And every time you make any progress, any micro progress, I felt better standing on the foot that time. It didn't result in any tangible progress, but I felt better. That's progress. I initiated a little bit of momentum out of this position. That's never happened before. I fell away an inch later, but I initiated momentum. I felt it. That's progress. Your count has to start over. You've got 7 more tries. And, you know, don't do these all in one session. This is over time we're talking about, because this is a, you know, this is something that's hard for you. This isn't something you're doing in a try or two, or you're not asking those questions. And I know that this sounds like a lot of time, right? Going through all these steps, there's not a, you know, a perfect checklist or a perfect series of questions that we can ask ourselves and then just have the answer. It takes a lot of time to work through the answers. These are physical puzzles after all, but it's not nearly as much time as gaining meaningful strength. And I think that most often you'll find your answer in those 7 tries, in those thinking outside the box and trying new beta and trying to settle on which way you're going to be giving your efforts to. You'll find your answer there. Now, like I said in the very beginning of this answer, keep building strength. It just can't be your immediate answer right now while you're standing in front of this boulder you want to try. Lydia, that's a fantastic question. I don't know if I answered it in the best way possible, but that is my answer. All right, another one, and this one is our final one from our Patreon, from Martin Bertram, another one from Martin. Martin, thanks for all these great questions. How can we evaluate what is holding us back from good movement? And he gives some examples here: fear, flexibility, lacking in hours of working the movements, strength, tension, etc. Another great one, and another hard one. I have to say the number one way to know, to evaluate what's holding us back, is to build awareness. Another thing that takes a lot of time here. You have to have experience climbing really well. You have to have climbed really well to know what climbing well feels like. Whatever you consider good movement to be. I'm not saying you have to have climbed like Dai Koyamada to know what good climbing feels like. What feels good for you? That's what I'm talking about here. You have to know how that feels to have a point of comparison, to even know that you're not moving well during this one move or this day or at this angle or whatever. And if you haven't just already developed that awareness naturally, or you didn't pick it up from another sport or something like that, the only way to do it, even if you have developed it naturally, you should still be doing this, is to be really intentional and reflective about your climbing. Particularly, I'm not going to say particularly. You should just always be intentional and reflective about your climbing. And now the examples you give here, Martin, are really interesting. And I'm going to echo some things I said in the answer to Lydia's question. Strength and flexibility, those are never the immediate answers. They can't be, because you can't come by those things quickly. So if you know you aren't flexible enough to use a specific position, instead of saying, oh, well, I have to go get more flexible, I'll be back in 2 or 3 years to try this, you just have to find another way. You have to at least look for another way to do the move. 99.9% of moves you're ever going to encounter have other solutions. So look for those. Fear or anxiety or disbelief that we've already talked about a little bit with footholds, those are probably the biggest limiters. Those come into play all the time. And if you're paying attention to your thoughts, if you've developed that awareness, you'll know when those things arrived. If you haven't developed the awareness, those things very often show up looking like hesitation or indecision. So have your friends watch for it or watch video of yourself. And the key here is to call it out as soon as you notice it. And then you have to take steps to change it, or it's going to get harder and harder and harder to move past. Let's say you're scared of a move. You say take, or you drop off or hesitate, or you barely catch the hold every time you get there because you're hesitating. What is it you're expecting to happen up there if you just do the same thing every time? That you'll just magically not be scared, not have that anxiety, not hesitate? It doesn't work that way. It's not going to happen. You have to make changes. Maybe that's hang at the bolt below so that you're fresh, and now push through it. Build your belief a little bit, and then a bolt lower. You know, power spot it, or get power spotted with the instruction to your power spotter that I'm not hesitating. So as soon as you see me in position to go, I'm going. So have your power spot ready. Whatever tactic you need to use that can inch you closer to doing the thing. And you have to be really brutally honest with yourself. Baby steps here are absolutely fine, encouraged, as long as they're baby steps forward. And your final example here, or one of your final examples, lacking in hours of working the movements, I think good is relative. It's the best that you have available. So if you're not flexible enough, if you're not strong enough, if you haven't had the hours to develop Daikyo Yamada's movement skill, which most of us don't have that many hours in our lifetimes, then we have to think of good movement as relative to what we have available. It's things like fear and anxiety that block what we have available from being accessible in the moment. Those are the things we have to really pay attention to. And Martin, your final example here, tension. I do think that tension, all five of these elements, tension, position, commitment, effort, rhythm, these are things we should always be working on in some way or another. And I don't think we can avoid working on them, but if we can be intentional about the ones that matter most for us, that makes a big difference. Same as strength, flexibility, our mental game. I think this is the technical component of climbing that has been missing. And like I said before, I've been working on a tool to assess where you stand within those elements and where you should be focusing your efforts, what will be the most bang for your buck, the most return on your investment. And I'll say within the next 30 days, within the next 30 days of the release of this podcast, I'm giving myself a deadline because I need one. I'm going to have a tool available for people to assess, as well as give you the blueprint for how to work on these elements of movement. I think this is something that's sorely been missing, and I think you're hitting on it here, Martin. How do we evaluate what's holding us back? I think this tool is going to be it. So if you want to be one of the first people to know when the tool is ready and out into the world, I'm going to be sending it out to the subscribers of The Current and to the patrons first. They'll be the first people to get access, and we'll have a period of people checking it out, testing it, giving me feedback, and letting me know how it's working for them. So if you want to be those folks, those links to the Patreon and to The Current, which is our monthly newsletter, those are right there in the description. All right, this was a ton of fun. Thank you, patrons, for asking all of these great questions. I'm going to try in the next few weeks to come up with a part two here from our Proven Plan group, as well as the Instagram and the YouTube. So until then, you guys know where to find us, powercompanyclimbing.com. Learn, grow, excel.